Hello, Brooklyn. How you doing? Where you going? We cannot come to. If I can, I'm gonna be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. So crazy. However you going, baby, where you going? Just take me, cause I'm so taken. If you take it, I'm just saying, baby. Hello, Brooklyn. How you doing? This is the Russell and Fro podcast with Russell here, Fro there. I am your long-haired co-host, Brett the Man Bun Garofalo, ready to talk all things Mets with longtime fan favorite Carl the Talent Jackson, a.k.a. the voice behind 99% of our tweets and 100% of our side gear. We have so much to get through this evening.
Brett, I am slathering my pecs in baby oil and getting ready to slide into the Ben Simmons Instagram feed. And I don't know if you caught this, Brett, big news on the Damian Lillard trade front today. Tyler Hero, long rumored to be the missing piece, the key piece in the Damian Lillard trade that the Nets fans have now sunk their excitement into, photographed. Shirtless, glistening, alongside a shirted, though sleeveless, Ben Simmons working out together in Miami. Brett, what does it mean?
Is this like when Mike Miller took the picture of himself working out, but he had the Heat jersey behind him or the LeBron jersey in the photo, where they're just dropping hints on social media? Maybe it's like that.
I mean, it could be. I do feel like Simmons stuff is like mildly like coordinated by him and his representation to just like try to get the idea out there. There was also the recent quotes at Summer League from Sean Marks and Dinwiddie gave an interview and Jacques Vaughn as well that the folks on the Locked On Nets podcast covered pretty well today, just about talking about how like this is the most positive that we've heard folks around the Nets speak of Ben Simmons in his entire tenure here. Certainly, you know, Steve Nash, I think is still figuring out the exit from the on ramp or the up ramp or the down ramp or whatever. You know, mostly it's kind of been like, doesn't necessarily seem like they're in the fold. But there've been some, you know, positive comments about him playing, obviously not necessarily clear where he is relative to expectations in terms of ramp up. But I think it was notable that Sean Marks said that he, you know, met with him recently down in Miami. He felt like Ben looked good physically and mentally. Spencer talked about how, you know, he's kind of, you know, getting him back into an all NBA form would be, you know, a huge add for this team. You know, how much of that is gassing up his trade value versus actual, you know, gassing up his trade value, gassing up fan expectations to cover off on, you know, what has otherwise been, I would say, regardless of your opinion on it, like a relatively boring free agency for the Nets, like hard to say, but I do think it's noteworthy that that they're speaking positively.
I feel like something has to fill the massive void that James Harden, Kyrie Irving, and Kevin Durant left in our hearts. And Nets fans are ready to grasp onto any shred of hope that might be out there. And Ben Simmons and his tantalizing upside represents more hope than anything else on the roster. Even if Mikal Bridges takes another leap next season, it's really tough to imagine that being a massive step. The real only massive step that we could take, or outside of somehow stealing Damian Lillard, which is not going to happen, is having a non-playing, basically you're going, it's like signing a free agent. Ben Simmons did nothing last year, and then all of a sudden you could have an all-NBA caliber defender, former number one pick on the team. That's huge. So I understand why people are getting excited about it. They see him practicing. There's no weird stuff going on. There's no mental health stuff going on. I looked it up. I was wanted to confirm what I was talking about earlier. So Mike Miller, before he signed with the Heat, posted a picture of him shooting around in the gym, and he had a LeBron James jersey clearly placed on the floor when he had all of these other pictures on the wall. This one had just been carted in. I think that Ben Simmons is the placed on the floor LeBron James jersey of the 2023 offseason. We're getting Tyler Hero, baby. It's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think so let's delve in. So I think also just in my interactions, this fan base is in, I'm not sure they're in a single place. They're all over the place. But all of the places are bad places. It seems like people are really struggling to adjust to the new world, the ennui of being stuck kind of in the middle here and trying to rebuild from sort of where they are. So let's kind of recap, I guess, what we've seen them do so far. And I think talk about sort of what we think that means and what we think is coming next. So in terms of, free agency, quick recap, I didn't write anything down, but I'm pretty sure I can get it off the top of my head. You tell me if I missed anybody. We have prioritized the signing of Dennis Smith Jr. Shouts to me and our guy Jared Alien on Twitter for calling that one out. That's been on in my radar for a while. Defensive first point guard, obviously bit of a reclamation project, former star, I would say, with or ascending star with Dallas, included in the Porzingis trade, went to New York, struggled there, kind of flamed out, was basically out of the league and ready to try out for the NFL a couple years ago. And then he came back, had a solid season as a backup point guard with Charlotte. So he's here. We got our guy, Lonnie Walker the IV, I believe. IV is the right numeral. Coming off the bench at backup scoring. And we can talk about what that means for one Cam Thomas. But I didn't watch it, but I guess he had a really good game 4 against the Warriors in the Lakers-Warriors series, where he scored a bunch and flashed some defensive potential, athleticism. Definitely all of these moves, we see the Nets kind of getting younger, prioritizing athleticism. And who am I forgetting there? I think that's pretty much it. I must be forgetting one other.
No, I don't think so. Aside from
obviously our biggest addition, which is going to be the king of summer league, Jalen Wilson, but we'll talk about him later.
We have a slot reserved for Jalen Wilson at the end of the podcast. And I don't want to yuck your yum here, but I do have a couple questions for you. One, what do you think the true shooting percentage was last season? Take a wild guess.
Who's true shooting percentage?
The league average. So the whole league.
54%.
Pretty close. It was 58. What do you think Dennis Smith Jr.'s true shooting percentage was last season?
Not 58. I would say his was probably closer to 43, something like that. It's something in the 40s.
Not 58. It's 47%.
All right, it's better than 43.
But he was, he played incredible defense. He could have been an all-defensive player, I think. He can get to the rim. Both things that the Nets are sorely lacking at the guard position. I think that's going to be great. But he signed for near the minimum for a reason,
right?
As did Lonnie Walker. And you alluded to that game. I happened to be watching it. He scored 15 points in the fourth quarter. He was the reason that the Lakers won that game. He certainly is a microwave that can go off at any moment, which is a great guy to have on the bench. You throw him in, he makes a couple shots. Great, keep the guy in. He doesn't, and he's not playing great defense. Take the guy out. And I almost think he's like the anti Cam Thomas in that respect, because he can come in after not playing the whole game and get hot right away. Whereas I think you pointed out in the past, Cam Thomas is one of those guys that needs to play his way into getting hot. It can be quite detrimental until he gets there.
Was it on the pod or after the pod last week when we were doing extending the microwave analogy and talking about Cam Thomas being like one of those old school electric stove coil? I think this is over text, but like one of those old school electric stoves where like you crank it to like, 3 and it takes 20 minutes to heat up. And so you're trying to like cook something on it and you're not sure. And then like all of a sudden, like so you crank it up to like 6 or 8 or something. And then like it gets super hot and then you're fucked because like you're like everything's boiling over and it won't cool back down for another like 15 minutes. That's like Cam Thomas. So it's good to hear that Lonnie Walker is a microwave. I think we can talk about what that means for Cam Thomas kind of as we move on in this conversation to talk about like the Nets direction. But I think it's interesting because I feel like I've heard Cam Thomas referred to as a microwave scorer so many times, or at least filling that role that you would want from a microwave type scorer. So it is interesting to me, or at least the signing of Lonnie Walker does not display a ton of confidence in Cam Thomas's future with this team. But let's talk about that. So I think the other sort of topic du jour of the past few weeks with the Nets has just been, it doesn't necessarily feel to a lot of people like there's a plan here, or that there's a direction here, because, you know, we hear them being included in trade talks. We've heard them rumored for Damian Lillard, interested to see sort of what that means. We hear them, you know, as the third team to take Tyler Hero back in a Damian Lillard trade as well. And we'll talk about the likelihood of that as well. But it seems a little bit stuck in between sort of blow it up. And we know that fully blowing it up is maybe not available because of the draft pick situation. But at least selling guys for assets should be, right? It's surprising maybe to many that Royce O'Neal is still on this team. It's surprising to many that Dorian Finney-Smith is still on this team. There's also some clear holes that haven't necessarily been addressed in terms of rebounding and things like that. So I guess, Brett, like, how do you feel direction-wise? Like, is this, are we a rudderless ship here? Does Sean Marks know what he's doing? Like, what do you, give me a pulse check on that.
I understand why Nets fans are frustrated and upset, knowing that we're not a team that's anywhere near contention. A logical next step would be to make moves to either gather to make us closer to contention in the future, or make win now moves to get us closer to contention. And the Nets haven't done either. I think the reason that we haven't done either is more comforting than the situation as is, which is, it seems like the Nets are slow playing, flipping the pieces that they have for assets, maintaining flexibility in the hope that an opportunity that they believe is worth pops up, and focusing on development just in case that doesn't pop up. So they're doing all of these things to hedge against the possible scenarios that they get into. Hey, we have to develop. A star doesn't become available that we think is worth cashing in the Phoenix and the Dallas and the Sixers picks for. Okay, great. We'll just keep building through the picks that we have, even if they're in their late 20s, and hope that some of these guys develop into stars. Or, hey, somebody does become available, we flip that and we structure to build around them, and we might not be a contender right away, but if we're good enough, another star is probably going to want to come to New York. So I'm fine with the direction because we haven't muddied our books for the future. We have a ton of flexibility and we have the infrastructure to take on almost any star and fit a great defense and complementary pieces around them. And we have assets that other teams want. So even though it didn't happen now, I believe that it didn't happen now because the Nets think that they can get more for the assets that other teams are interested in. And those teams are going to be more desperate at the trade deadline after next season. And that's when we'll see a potential Neal or Dorian Finney-Smith flipped for picks or younger players that we think we can develop. What do you think about that?
I'm 100% with you. I mean, to me, I feel like this is, I mean, I think they have picked a direction. It's clear to me that they have. I mean, if you look at the draft picks that they made with Noah Clowney and Derek Whitehead, and you look at the coaching staff that they've hired, Kevin Holly, Burrell, Will Weaver, like, really, I think going all in on development, to me, that is their priority number one. And I think, you know, I'm sure I sound like a Sean Marks stan.
Marxist.
I'd say. other kinds of Marxists, but I don't know. Like, I am rooting for the guy, and I'll check that bias in up front. I'm always the latest to turn on somebody. I did that with Kevin Ollie, frankly, at UConn. I did that with Steve Nash. As well, like, it is very comforting to me to have, like, the people in charge of the things that I like and want to be successful, like, feeling like they are competent. So I acknowledge that bias. I think if I break down sort of like why I think Sean Marks did a good job during his first tenure, it was in recognizing the unique constraints that the Nets were in at that point without having a pick. And defining the problem that needed to be solved, specifically in that case, and finding ways to do it. And so what I think, kind of what you said about, you know, what's exciting about the direction that we've seen them take here is it conveys to me a recognition of what those constraints are this time and sort of where they are. And I think they're in better position than they were. They're obviously in a better position than they were at the beginning of the rebuild last time. I think they're in a better position than they were in 2019 as well. I think Mikhail is probably the best player of everybody between that 2019 roster and this roster. So you're starting from something. You've got Bridges on, you know, an amazing contract. And I think, you know, trying to develop him into taking a leap as a player is a great place to be starting. I think rehabbing Ben Simmons' value, understanding what the new CBA is going to mean for his value going forward, makes a ton of sense. I think, you know, having a guy like Cam Johnson that's plug and play around the league, obviously getting paid money, but the more you kind of read about his contract, like the sticker, that initial sticker shock is wearing off. That was a third guy I was thinking of actually before when we were naming things as like the biggest signing. You know, because I think they've talked about some unlikely bonuses being included there, which brings the overall number down, and also structuring it as a declining money deal, which I think if the Nets were to be in a position to try to contend and accelerate this thing, puts them in a better spot to add talent, and B, like if they need to move on from him, and you know, that makes that obviously a much more palatable contract to take. So, to me, it is a focus on development, a focus on leveling up the guys that they have. And I think it's a recognition that when you're in a position where there is no incentive to be bad, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's an incentive to be good. So it does leave you in this kind of frustrating middle place as a fan. But I think that recognition of like, let's see what we have here. And let's recognize that one of the assets that we do have is our ability to give playing time and give looks to guys and try things out on the court that, you know, might be too risky for other teams. I mean, if you contrast like what the Nets have done this offseason with like the Wizards, right? Like obviously the Wizards like cut bait on all. I mean, the Beal situation was unique just because of the no trade clause and things like that. But like, even if you look at like the Monty Morris trade and you know, other moves that they've made, it's really about clearing the decks, getting off money, blowing things up to restart the franchise. But inherent to that making sense is the idea that like pressing the reset button actually puts you closer to where you want to go because you have the ability to make high draft picks moving forward. The Nets don't have that. So it doesn't necessarily make sense to just chuck everybody off the roster unless you're going to get a good deal. And to your point, I think if you look at like a Royce O'Neal or Dorian Finney-Smith, those are both guys probably that whose value as an asset, I think, and I use that term to mean like player contract combination, is probably higher than their on-court value. And I think they're both guys where you're going to extract the most value in a trade for them at the trade deadline or into the season when somebody else's other option hasn't panned out, because it's probably tough to stomach giving up a first round pick for a year of Royce O'Neal right now, when there are other options available that you could go out and get. And I'm not saying that the Nets will get a first round pick for them, for him or two firsts for Dorian Finney-Smith. I think they might, but I think that, you know, putting yourself in a position where you got a team like Memphis last year, where, you know, they're closer in, the league feels wider open, like they're really trying to go for it. Like that's what you need. And I think the more the more I sort of look at this and look at deals and stuff like that, like the person, the team that you're dealing with, sort of where they're at, is just as meaningful to the equation as like the quote unquote value of the individual player. So I think it's a smart move by Sean Marks.
That's a great point, Carl. What kind of desperate, rudderless franchise would trade a first round pick for Royce O'Neal?
Well, I mean, in fairness, that was like a very protected first round pick, and I think he's proven to be worth that.
True. Good point.
And that was 2 years of Royce O'Neal, but again, like that was like him. He is one of the guys that fits into a trade exception that the Nets had last year. There was not a lot of avenues for them to add wing help. Like, I think it's understanding those constraints and layering some of those on. Whereas at the beginning of free agency, theoretically anybody could be like, I mean, guys that are actual free agents are available. Guys that are getting traded, you know, can be available for cheap. Like you see these like you know, guys get flung around for much, much less. And you know, I think it's a little bit of a clearer, or you're going to be more likely to part with serious future assets toward the deadline when you know that like, this is our chance to win. Like that's, it's just a different calculus right. than trying to build a roster in the off season. When you don't know what's going to work out.
It's such a great point about wings too. Think about all the wings that have been traded in the past 2 years. It's really, really tough to find those names. And the Nets were only able to pick up three starting caliber wings by trading all-time Hall of Fame players, Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant. We can separate all the other stuff from Kyrie Irving and if he'll actually get into the Hall of Fame. But talent-wise, he's a Hall of Fame player. As I was listening to you talk, and I think I came to the that the two opportunities that Lion from understanding Marx is great at understanding the opportunities based on how the roster is constructed, the assets, where the league is, I believe are flexibility and then also the timeline that we're on. Because the timeline that we're on with the age of our players gives us the ability to be super patient that we have and pick and choose the scenarios where a star might become available. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I still believe that that is plan A. I don't think the Nets think they're going to find that 1A star by drafting or with the players that are currently on the roster. That person is going to have a trade or potentially a free agent, but free agency might not even be more. Folks are going for those large contracts and they're asking for a trade. So I do believe that that's plan A on the path to contention, but we don't have to act on that for 2 to 3 years if we don't want to. And the Nets are hedging against that with structuring the rest of the organization around development and going young, just in case that doesn't happen for a while. And I think that's super smart. So they are towing both lines, in my opinion. But one of those lines doesn't really affect anything until it does. Now, that's a weird way to say that, but we have no idea what those opportunities are going to be when they become available. But I think that's what we want to do.
I agree with that. But the only thing that I would add, well, and I'm projecting my own opinions.
Me too.
Like, I think part of this is it's a little bit of a bake-off between the two lines that they're telling, right? Like, I think it's a little bit of a situation where if all of a sudden, like, Dariq Whitehead were to look amazing this year and the Nets were to really feel like that's, you know, the direction that they wanted to go in, like, I could see them making a pivot at that point and trying to shop Mikal Bridges or Cam Johnson. I sort of don't think that that's as likely, but I do think that that's reasonable where, like, all of a sudden, like, you could quickly coalesce around a timeline where it's like, okay, no, we're actually about this young group here because, you know, we feel like there's more here. Otherwise, I feel like it's diversifying the roster essentially and trying to play as many different angles as you can. So I guess like one other thing, I guess like that kind of segues into sort of our next question. I'm going to reverse what I told you.
Let's go
a little bit. Like, so let's say they don't do anything else. And let's say the roster that they have right now is where they're walking into training camp with. Like, how viable is it in your opinion? And what are, like, are there any holes that you feel like absolutely must get filled? So basically, like, I'm thinking, I guess let's assume that Ben Simmons is an NBA player.
So
you're looking at a starting group of probably Ben Simmons as your point guard, Spencer Dinwiddie, Mikal Bridges, Cam Johnson, and Nick Claxton as your starting five, I think. Royce O'Neal, Dorian Finney-Smith, Dennis Smith Jr., Lonnie Walker, and then probably De'Ron Sharp is your sort of second unit there. Cam Thomas, Jalen Wilson, and the rest of the rookies kind of in that stay ready group. I guess the biggest assumption I'm making there is that Ben Simmons and Nick Claxton can coexist in that starting group. Do you think that that's fair? Like, how viable do you think that is?
I've been doing a lot of thinking about that. I know that you and I were talking about those stats from last year where the on-off rating with Simmons and Claxton together was not great. I personally think that we have to throw out any on-off, any advanced stats when it comes to Ben Simmons. Last year, he was clearly a shell of himself, both physically and mentally. And that doesn't mean that I now suddenly think these Claxton-Simmons lineups are going to be incredible, but it's really tough to make a call on that without past precedent. Now, what I will say about this is I don't think it's the end of the world if Simmons and Claxton can't play together outside of, let's say, 5 minutes a game, because we saw players like Dorian Finney-Smith be able to come in and play a small ball five, which I think would be a very interesting lineup around Ben. And we can take Ben out of the game. Like, maybe he's not going to play more than 25 minutes. And then you can surround Clax with shooters. So there's ways to tinker and tool around it that makes Simmons and Clax not being able to play together or not being able to rating together not as catastrophic as you would think. Not being able to play your best players on the court at the same time for extended stretches would. I think it will probably be neutral at to answer your question.
Do you feel like is that the group that you would, if that was sort of your lineup, is that, or if that was your roster basically, like, is that the group that you would start, or would you change it up?
I think you have to start that lineup unless it goes really, really poorly. I think for Simmons to regain his confidence, and then I think for the rest of those players, like Clax, you can't throw him to the bench. You can't put Dinwiddie, Bridges, or Johnson on the bench. So it's really just about it's really about rebuilding Simmons. That's what it is. And I totally get that. He needs to know that he's got the entire organization behind him. Everybody, including the players, is giving him a vote of confidence. And he's the one potentially odd guy out in that starting lineup. So if it doesn't work, it's very easy to say, hey, this isn't working. Maybe you tinker around him, or maybe you just say, hey, let's come off the bench and see what happens. So I would start with that to build Ben Simmons' psyche and confidence back up, but be prepared to pivot away from it, especially if he looks closer to last season than closer to the old Ben Simmons.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think the two obvious need areas are playmaking and rebounding with this team and this roster. And I think that starting lineup in theory should sort of try to mitigate both of those.
Or rebound, for sure.
We should, right? Like, there's enough height across the positions. Let's talk about rebounding for a second, because that's been a big topic of conversation as well with the Nets. Both like choosing Clowney over like Leonard Miller, let's say, who's looked really good in summer league, not going out and grabbing a traditional power forward. I think, you know, you look at Cam Johnson, you know, rebounding is probably not his top skill. I don't know that that's really a top skill for Dorian Finney-Smith or Royce either. And, you know, I think, I guess my question is, and it's the last thing I'll say is, like, it's like an area sort of near and dear to my heart, because it's the only thing that I've ever been really good at in basketball. And it's also just very misunderstood, I feel like, in the way that people analyze the game. To me, like, the rebounding stuff is going to be as much about like schematical shifts as it is about players and roster. Was in a conversation with, I think it was Brooklyn Nets 85 today, about like everybody's like bitching and moaning about like not like making an offer sheet for Paul Reed and all this stuff. And, you know, like the backup center is really not going to impact it, to say nothing of, and I meant to do this in a cleverer way, but De'Ron Sharpe was like a top five, it was top five in like offensive rebound rate last season, just straight up. Like he is a very good rebounder.
Yeah.
He's not necessarily a very good like basketball player right now. And so the fact that he's a very good,
you don't know that, you don't know what he's going to look like next season.
And I mean, no. And I think it's reasonable to expect a jump. I mean, I think it is reasonable to plug him in as a backup center just to see what you have there. And I think that like goes back to sort of the strategic shift being more about development, knowing that you can compete, but not necessarily like having to compete.
That's the point that I was making. I don't think they signed a rebounder because they want to see what they have in De'Ron Sharpe. And then we can always try to snag a rebounder if we need it.
I guess my only other question though is, to me, like, this becomes a bit of a Nick Claxton question. And they had at one point, you know, Jacques Vaughn had basically said that they were going to play Claxton and drop more to try to, you know, not get beat on the glass every game. And I think that's a big part of it. I think a big part, I mean, Lucas Kaplan had a really good thread the other day, actually about the Liberty, where it was showing how, like, they're bringing, you know, Jonquel Jones up to, like, the level on coverages, and Brianna Stewart is, you know, coming in as a help defender. And basically you're left with, like, your guards essentially having a block out on the weak side, and that becoming, like, a really difficult thing. And I feel like that's the situation that the Nets were in a lot last season, because Nick Claxton has, like, superpower is his ability to switch onto the perimeter. And when the Nets were playing Ben Simmons, like, as a center, in theory, even though he guards the point of attack in a lot of instances, like, you're also, you know, putting him on the perimeter, and then you're left with guys that are smaller, essentially filling in down low and filling in on the dirty work. And I feel like there's, like, that sort of cross match piece of it that they're going to have to figure out. But there's also just the question of, like, how, I mean, Nick Claxton was awesome last year. He was in the top 10 for defensive player of the year, voting top five, maybe. He was, you know, on the most improved.
I think he was top five.
He was on the most improved, you know, ballot. Maybe he was top 10 and most improved player. Deservedly so, because of his defense. How much are you hampering his defense, and how much are you hindering his value by forcing him to play in a drop coverage? That to me is the question. Like, how much can he grow and succeed in that particular role, in that particular scheme, when you're not letting the fact that he can switch onto any guard be part of his bag, so to speak? Or do you just figure that you let him do what he does and you live with the fact that you're going to get beat on the glass because of it?
I'm not sure if you're necessarily limiting his value. You might be expanding his value by showing his ability to play both drop and switch at a high level, because we haven't played that much drop with Claxton. And if he shows he can do and anchor a defense that's in the top 10, then all of a sudden he's this great roaming switch defender blocked from the weak side, or he's a guy that can stand in there and protect the rim. And that's a super, super valuable center versus many other teams that need to have their drop coverage guy, and then they need to have their switchability guy. And that's why you see centers not getting paid that much, because they're usually just one trick ponies. And even then they're getting beat by quicker players. I don't know if it limits his value. I think it actually really helps his potential career earnings long-term by being able to do that. It will probably play the Nets out of being able to re-sign him, but who knows? Maybe he takes a hometown discount. He seems like the type of guy that likes being in the limelight and likes being in. I don't want to pivot from this conversation yet, but I do want to talk about rebounding in a second. But any thoughts on that before I switch over?
No, I mean, I hadn't meant it explicitly in terms of, like, market value, but I think that's a really good point too. It's more just like how, like, I guess ultimately, like, it comes down to, like, how are you going to be the best defense that you can be?
Yeah.
And rebounding may be part of that, but that may be a conscious decision that you're making in order to be the best defense that you can be.
They won't always be playing drop. I don't see a scenario where we're not playing switching defense a lot this season. So maybe that's why I'm not as concerned about it.
Okay. I think that makes sense. I mean, and I think we'll just have to sort of see how it goes.
Yeah. I think he can do it. I think he'd be fine at it.
I think he would be too. I think he was fairly successful when they did it last year. It's just more of a question of, like, I don't know. I just keep coming back to this idea of, like, your goal defensively is to, like, stop the other team from scoring. It doesn't inherently you can't do without rebounding the basketball. So, like, it's very tied in, but, like, it's not just about rebound rate, and the fact that he blocks as many shots as he does, you know, changes the rebound.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like a dichotomy between your goal as a coach is to recognize your players' strengths and their weaknesses and put them in a position to maximize their strengths. But then you're balancing that with the goal of the team, which is to score as many points as possible and hold the opponent to as few points as possible. And those things aren't always parallel. Like, you might have to play Nick Claxton out of position for the betterment of the team, like you're saying. And if it does elevate the rest of the defense, then fuck it, let's do it. So I'm okay with that, and showing that he has that flexibility, yeah, I think is great. I think it's part of his. But I did want to go ahead. Sorry, I said I did want to touch about rebounding for a second.
No,
I think that you're right. It's a scheme. It's a structural thing. I always bring up Brook Lopez, so I won't go too much into that. But he was a guy that was maligned for years, and now is highly respected and getting massive contracts because he's a drop coverage guy, but also because he drastically increases the defensive rebound percentage of the teams that he's on when he's in the game, even if he's not grabbing rebounds, because he boxes out like an absolute beast. Where I do think the lack of size and individual rebounding hurts a team is in crunch time and in the playoffs, where the value of offensive rebounding goes way up. We don't have those guys that can stand near the rim. And even if the rest of the team mentally breaks down, because boxing guys out and playing one possession perfect, lower percentage if you don't have great rebounders. But throughout the course of many possessions and at scale and during a game, it doesn't affect that much. But on those pivotal possessions in the playoffs or in crunch time, I think that's where it hurts teams. And that's why I think you don't see Marks prioritizing bringing in somebody that can help with that, because we're just not really a team where those possessions matter to us right now or matter enough to spend a lot of money. So that's how I'm thinking about
it. Yeah, I think that's fair.
That's like
champagne problems.
Yeah, exactly. That's something that you're like, hey, wow, this is something that we want to make sure isn't as big of a hole for us, because we're a contending team. And man, it would really suck to lose a 7-game series because we missed one offensive rebound. It's worth paying this backup center $10 or $12 million. Like, yeah, that would be an awesome problem to have. That's not a problem the Nets have.
Yeah. And I think the other school of thought is, And this is one that I'm a little bit more aligned with. Like, if the Nets could have brought in like a 4-5 tweener, like, I feel like they've got a lot of 3-4 guys and they've got a lot of 2-3 guys. They don't necessarily have any sort of 4-5 tweener, unless you want to count Claxton.
And Clowney, baby. Big minutes.
Bringing in sort of a bigger body like that, that could rebound and shoot, and could play a small ball five sort of with Ben Simmons on the floor. Like, to me, you could make the argument that even though we don't care about it from a playoff perspective, like, bringing somebody like that in to give Ben the best chance of making it work this year. I could see the wisdom in something like that. That's where I had sort of hoped for Gudario Saric or Grant Williams. Or that type of player that's not necessarily like a center per se, but is somebody that could play. Because I mean, there's this whole thing last year of like, oh, Ben Simmons will play the five. Like, Ben Simmons might play the five on offense, I suppose, but like, he's definitely not playing the five on defense ever. Like, you want him guarding the point of attack. You want him guarding, you know, at the very least, like, you know, the wing creators. On the other team, you want him guarding Jason Tatum. Like, he's just not sitting near the basket, you know, playing like the quote unquote five role in any way. And so, like, when you have lineups where he's the tallest guy on the floor by a lot, which he was with the bench a lot last year, like, it's one thing if you're asking Dorian Finney-Smith to do that. It's one thing if you're asking Grant Williams to do that. It's a completely different thing if you're asking like Joe Harris or like Royce O'Neal to be that guy. And I think that that's where the Nets sort of found themselves a lot last season. And so I think trying to avoid that would be something that I would be interested in. And maybe the answer as part of that is like getting guys that are a little bit more athletic, a little bit more stout, whether that's, you know, Dennis Smith or, you know, who's obviously not big, not tall, but is, you know, bigger, like more physical dude. You know, Lonnie Walker, I think is a pretty, you know, at least high athleticism player. Like, you know, that maybe is the way that they cover for it. And you're not giving as many minutes to Seth Curry or, Patty Mills or Joe Harris.
I mean, even Yuta Watanabe, he wasn't a great defender. He just hustled. And that's why Nets fans loved him. He was really fun to watch. But yeah, that's the difference between Simmons and Klax, because if you wanted to put Ben at the five, he's not going to be a drop rim protector. He's just not. He's going to be a bigger body down there that might be able to force some people out of the paint, but he's not going to be a guy that really deters the other team from getting to the rim. And that's why I like Claxton's flexibility in different types of lineups more than I like Simmons outside of the fit offensively, where obviously Simmons is best when he's surrounded by shooters and floor spacers.
Right. But coming back to that lineup that we talked through, I mean, like now you're talking about, Simmons, like, as your nominal, like, one or, yeah, like, in the backcourt with Spencer Dinwiddie, who's, like, 6'6", 6'5", and then you've got Bridges, who plays big, Cam Johnson, who's 6'9", and Claxton. Like, that's a big lineup. That's quite athletic. Yeah. So I think you can mitigate it that way. But I guess let's get into the thing that we had wanted to talk about before this, which is the other deficiency area in terms of playmaking. And Tyler and the possibility of needing a hero, right?
A sandwich?
Well, that's not, so first of all, let me just say, I was thinking about this on my drive home today. I'm fully in support of this just for the puns alone, between the hero sandwich and, Iron Eagle would have a field day and it would make the Nets a lot more fun. So certainly in from that regard, regardless of what you think about it in terms of asset management. But we could walk through numbers and deals and stuff like that. I guess the basic idea here is, sounds like the Nets are out of the Damian Lillard derby, but they may be involved as the third team to take Tyler Hero off the Trailblazers' hands. He is 23 years old. He's due a lot of money over the next few years, but with the cap going up, seems like a relatively flippable deal. I think he's a great candidate for a sort of change of location glow up. And we've already seen the glowing in his Instagram photos with Ben Simmons. But I think, coming to a team that's so starved for shot creation and so starved for offensive playmaking, essentially, I think would make a ton of sense. I don't necessarily know that he works as a point guard per se. So I think there's some lineup machination stuff to figure out. But where do you want to start here? Do you want to just start with the general idea, or do you want me to walk through like what the potential packages might be?
Personally, I think it makes sense to start with the broad concept, general concept. Do we want Tyler Hero on the team? And then once we get a gauge of where both of us are at, then we can talk through what we'd be willing to trade for him, if anything. But I think it helps to just gauge what the general value in a vacuum of adding Tyler Hero to the team is. But do you want to start? Or do you want me to?
I mean, okay. Sure, I'll start. In my opinion, it's exactly what I said, right? Which is like, you need somebody to run the offensive engine of this team. With all due respect to Spencer Dinwiddie, and with all due respect to Mikal Bridges, like I guess yes. Mikal's the important one, right? Like everything I said in terms of Mikal's development of trying to develop Mikal into best case scenario. I mean, astronomically best case scenario, Kawhi Leonard. More reasonably, maybe a Chris Middleton or like even a Jeremy Grant, like, plus player, a guy that's established himself as a really effective role player that can take a more active role handling the ball. Like, I think to put him in a position to succeed, it would be helpful to give him a running mate that is going to take some focus of defenses away from him and is going to allow him some space to really like shine through. And I think Tyler Hero, again, comes with flaws and warts and all that kind of stuff, but like absolutely would be somebody that can solve the, creation at the end of games problem that they have last year. And would just bring a lot of what they're missing. So I think his impact would be sort of outside. Like, I think you can make the argument that he's more valuable coming to the Nets than he would be almost any other franchise, because they're just so in need of somebody like that and so able to cover for the deficiencies that he would have on the defensive side of the ball that, like, I think it makes a ton of sense. So I think that's my argument for it. I don't think he's, you're not trading for a star. This is not making you a championship contender. This is, leveling you from sort of the low middle to the middle or the high middle. Like, and so there's that piece of it as well. There's a ceiling that kind of comes with it too. So it's, I'm not like writing home about it. I think eventually you probably trade him or he becomes a sixth man. Like, I think he's probably a sixth man or at least a guy that starts and doesn't finish games for a really good contender, would be my guess. And you'd be asking him to be in a bigger role here, but just as a type of player, if the price is right, I think it makes a ton of sense. What's your thought?
I think you're spot on that we'd still be middle class, but we'd be like upper middle class. Like, you know, maybe one of us got stock options from our company. They're going to pay off long term, and all of a sudden it's like, maybe we can splurge on the bigger house, at least in the short term. So I want to touch upon a couple of things that you said. One, I completely agree. The Nets would be infinitely, infinitely more watchable with Tyler Hero, because we wouldn't be relying on guys that are number twos at best offensively. Mikhail could be a number one defensively. Spencer Dinwiddie can't be a number one defensively, but he's better or most effective off the ball, as we saw with Luka, or even when he was on the Nets and D'Angelo Russell had a 75% usage percentage. So with Hero, it's offensive. I know. I mean, the guy's turning 24 in January. Last season, he averaged 25-4 on 37% shooting from three and 93% from the line. And he was the Heat's best offensive player. So you know he was getting guarded on those threes too. These aren't just wide open threes that Jimmy Butler is kicking out to him. So that's super impressive. And 93% from the line is nuts. What I wanted to dig into, what I'm glad you mentioned, was the defensive side of the house. Because what I originally thought was, hey, that's awesome that Hero is this great offensively. He's a bit of a ball handler. He can take that pressure off of Mikal Bridges and Spencer Dinwiddie. He can make the Nets infinitely more watchable, but does that outweigh what he's going to take off the floor on defense? And even though it's more fun to have him on the team, is the team effectively going to have the same net rating and be a sixth seed at best, which is what I view the Nets roster as currently constructed. So I'll dig into this a little bit. I promise I won't spend too much time on this, but I did some reading up on Hero's defense. I read a couple articles by Heat Nation, and I read a couple comments by some opposing GMs. And effectively, the skinny on him is he's never had good defensive instincts. Again, not teaching anybody anything new here, but this is things that scouts have noted, GMs have noted. And prior to last season, he was a guy that was targeted specifically on defense by other teams. That's how bad he was. And so much so that the Heat had to devise their defense around hiding him. And that was up until last season. There were some positives. So last season, he improved a bit, only averaged 0.8 steals, but that was a career high. And some folks noted that, hey, listen, you can't teach defensive instincts. He'll never have that. But now he knows where to be on the court, and he actually tries to be in those positions, which he'd never done before. So there's effort being put in, and because of that, they noticed that other opposing defenses weren't targeting him as much. So I thought that was pretty positive. And then another thing that they noted, which I think is really pertinent if the Nets do trade for him, is one of the things that helped with his, I don't want to say defensive ascendance, but just improvement, is they removed Duncan Robinson from the lineups with him in it, or from the lineup altogether, which just makes his playoff run all the more wild. And when that happened, Hero was the weakest defender in all of their lineups, meaning that he was now getting the easiest assignment on defense. And that also helped with him not being a net negative on that end of the floor. And the reason I say that is if he comes to the Nets roster and we don't have to give up much to get him, he will probably be the weakest defender on the floor with us. So that improvement in value wouldn't necessarily go off the table with the Nets. So after that long diatribe, I think that, so it's still not great, but it's better than I expected. And I believe that he would be neutral or close enough to neutral defensively with the Nets to make the offense that he's going to have and the ease of burden he's going to bring to Mikal Bridges worth giving up a couple assets for him, which is a bit of an about face than where I was before I was reading up on him a little bit, because I just thought, hey, we're all getting suckered into his offense and we're not really thinking about what he's going to take off the floor on the other end to neutralize that. And also, I think in the future, his contract, which everybody is maligning, is going to be much more tradable as the cap continues to go up 10% a year. So anyway, that was a really, really long monologue, but thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think that's great to hear. I mean, I was always sort of assuming that you were going to be able to cover his defensive weaknesses just with the length and point of attack defense that they have on the floor, whether you're pairing him with, you know, like I'd be yeah. really interested to see him and Dennis Smith Jr. like share the floor, but definitely him and Ben Simmons, definitely, you know, him, Ben, McHale. Like I feel like you've got guys to throw at, you know, the other team's best player. You know, if just in service of kind of letting him cook, I'd be interested to see what the return is. And I think that's obviously going to be the sticking point. And my guess honestly is like, that's probably the sticking point in the entire, you know, works of the Dame trade, aside from just there not being additional offers that Portland is interested in. I think I would draw the line at one pick, basically, unless there's, you know, more things involved. But I think, you know, like one pick in Dinwiddie or one pick in Simmons would be where I would sit. I think I would trust the team to choose between those two guys. Or you're assembling like a multiplayer, you know, like you could get to kind of the magic number that Eric Slater had tweeted, where the Nets get Hero and stay out of the tax, with like, you know, a Finney Smith, Cam Thomas, Edmund Sumner package, potentially. So like, you know, I think there's ways to do it, where I wouldn't be too worried. But it all depends on what you're giving up. I wouldn't give up more than two picks. And I, even if I feel like he could potentially be worth that, I just don't feel like for the Nets, given where they are, like it would be a time to throw in more for him right now.
I completely agree with you. First round pick is where I draw the line too. And I'm fine with giving up a first round pick and a player that could probably get a first round pick like Royce O'Neal. And hell, I might even give up Dorian Finney-Smith, which is tough because I think we can probably get more for him. But if it's just a player and one first round pick, that's fine. I'm also super. So let's say this trade happens and Simmons isn't in the trade. That would mean that all the stuff that Marks has been saying is true instead of him trying to jack up his trade value. And that also means that the Nets believe that Simmons is going to have a good season and get back to form. So that would be a wild turn of events in my mind if all of a sudden Simmons isn't the one shipped out and the Nets are thinking, no, we want to keep this guy. We do think he's going to get back to form. We do think he's going to be a part of our course next season, which it's really, really, really tough to read between the lines and figure out what's window dressing and what's not right now. And this trade, if the Nets are involved, I think is going to be the biggest indicator of how the Nets actually feel about Simmons and how his development and his recovery is really going.
Do you think it goes now?
I want to say yes, based on the smoke. I think that all these tweets about other teams being involved and sticking points, the Nets have been the one team consistently mentioned throughout all of the swirl. And because of that, I do think that the trade goes down. And I think that we'll probably pay more than we want to for Tyler Hero. Those are my two predictions.
What do you think gets sent out for him?
I think Simmons gets sent out for him. And I think this is all Sean Marks blowing smoke to try to lower the amount of picks that we have to send out to get Hero.
I mean, I think I like the idea of him and Dinwiddie as well. I mean, full disclosure, like, I don't think that Ben Simmons is going to be an NBA player, or at least an NBA player for however many months are in the NBA season this upcoming year. Like, so I would cut bait on it and just abandon the theoretical idea that he could be, even though it's really fun to talk about defensive lineups.
I think that's the same.
I like the idea of a Dinwiddie Hero pairing, honestly. Like, I think that could be kind of interesting. Obviously, you know, makes it more difficult to cover for his defensive deficiencies because Spencer Dinwiddie is not great, and you put Dinwiddie in a worse position. Like, pairing like Dinwiddie and Ben Simmons like works really well because then you get the benefit of Dinwiddie being really large for his position. Pairing Dinwiddie and Hero, you kind of kneecap that a little bit. Same thing with like Dinwiddie and Luka, even though Luka's like not a good defender, like at least you're really big across the board. So, you know, I don't know. We'll see. I'm intrigued by it. I think it'd be fun. And I think to me, it makes sense just from the development standpoint that we talked about. Like, I think just getting somebody who can make shots and make shots down the stretch and just give a jolt to the offense, like, it's worth giving up a first round pick just in service of like helping run a coherent offense, basically. And so that's my thought. I do think it goes down, but I don't think it goes down until midseason.
Oh, interesting. Okay. You think it's going to get drawn out for that long?
I kind of do. I just don't like, I don't think, I just feel like from Portland's perspective, like, why wouldn't they wait? Like, what do they have to lose by letting it go into the season?
I completely
don't want to play the dude anyway.
I think that's really
smart. Why wouldn't you wait until somebody else gets desperate? It just worked for the Nets with Durant, even though I know that's not really what they were doing, but like, it definitely worked that way for them. It worked that way for Harden when he went to the Nets. Didn't work quite as well for Harden when he went to Philly. But that was like a little bit of a different situation with a pretty big extraneous circumstance. So like, I don't know. I don't see why you wouldn't wait longer, because worst case scenario, everything stays exactly the same.
Yeah, it's a really good point. As you were talking through it, all that does is benefit the Blazers and hurt the Heat, because they lost Gabe Vincent. They lost Cody Zeller. You keep hearing these rumblings that the relationship with Tyler Hero is irreparable. They go into the season with bad vibes, a thinned out roster, expecting Damian Lillard, and they can't necessarily make moves like Dame is going to be there without Dame there. So it really hamstrings them. So the Heat, if they haven't caved already, are going to cave. It's just a matter of whether or not their caving package is enough for the Blazers to sound like it is.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is, like, I don't know that there's like a lot else they can throw in. Like, to me, it's got to hinge on how somebody values Hero, which I guess could be, I mean, that's the other play that the Blazers could have is like, you've lost Gabe Vincent, you've lost Max Strus. Like,
yeah,
Tyler Hero would be assuming a much bigger offensive load coming into this season. Like, if they're able to do that and make that work, like, you know, does that jack his value up a little bit too? Maybe.
Yeah. I forgot about Strus. Good point. Yeah, that's fast. I think the Heat are going to be in a world of hurt there. It's going to be that's a nice shrewd Daryl Morey-esque move by Joe Cronin.
I mean, it just feels like the smart thing. I just don't know. I don't know. I just feel like that. Like, I just feel like the idea that you have to trade a disgruntled star, I think, is wearing off a little bit.
Especially how some of these franchises have been left after those trades. I think, hey, listen, we want to take care of our players. We want to take care of the people that have put a lot of time into these franchises, but we can't screw over the next 4 to 5 years of our franchise just to make you happy. So we're willing to get a little bit uncomfortable to do that.
Yeah. I mean, that Raphael Stone quote is like what I think of every time, which is like, we're comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, last thing I'll say on Tyler Hero is, ultimately, this comes down to how the trade makes me feel. And if I pull away from everything, the stats, the roster construction, what it means for the timeline, I'm infinitely more excited to watch this team for the next couple of years if Tyler Hero's on it than if I'm not. So as long as the price isn't crazy, I'm all for it. Bring him in. Let's have some fun. Bombs away.
Yeah. Point number one. Bonnie Tyler, we need a hero. Point number two, everything that Ian Eagle can do. David Bowie, we could be heroes. Sandwiches.
We could eat heroes.
Hero. Like, you know, imagine if he like yams went on like Giannis and there was like a whole hero thing. Yeah, that could be kind of fun. And number three, and don't sleep on this one, bucket hats.
Yes. And imagine if we keep Simmons somehow, they're both sitting on the bench in street clothes wearing bucket hats. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
High comedy. Like,
the bucket hat, and you know, Ben Simmons in his full Jamiroquai outfit with his fuzzy, like he's got like the fuzzy, like raver Kangol bucket hat going on.
It's an entertainment product before it's a sports product, Carl.
It's true. Uh-huh. It's true.
All right. Do you want to wrap up with some roster construction stuff, or do you want to talk summer league? What are you thinking?
Oh, let's talk summer league, because I haven't watched shit of it, but I'm excited about Jalen Wilson, and I think he's gonna like start probably. So please tell me about it.
Okay, cool. So I watched two of the Nets games and I missed the other two, but luckily I think the first two showed me enough that I can share some thoughts here. We'll start with Jalen Wilson because he's been the talk of Summer League. He's just fun. He's just a solid basketball player. What I was most impressed by was his ability to draw fouls, which I think is essential for a guy of his draft profile, which is not the fastest guy, not the most athletic guy, but quote unquote, just knows how to play basketball. All of those things are going to even more exposed when he's playing in the NBA. But if he has the intelligence to draw fouls, then he can get pretty far and be a positive on the floor. But if he's only relying on turnaround twos and jump shots, that could get dicey pretty quickly. So that was super enticing to me in terms of keeping his floor offensively consistent when he's out there. Other things that I really liked is he seems to be able to recognize when he has an advantage and take advantage of that. So pump faking, getting through and just understanding when to drive. I loved that. He had a couple great passes to find the open man. Didn't look like he was ever flustered out there, was ever sped up or slowed down. He was looking down the court every time the Nets inbound the ball to see if he could throw it down, and got a couple assists doing that. So I love people that push the ball up the floor and just have that level of awareness. I have a tough time judging how good guards are defensively. I'm guessing based on how quick he looked out there, he's going to be a neutral at best because he's not known for his athleticism, but just don't take my word for that because I'm just not a great judge of defense if it's a non-big man. So those are my
plus
thoughts.
Rebounder, though, I believe.
Yeah. He's big for his size. And he actually, the game that we had today, the Nets were up by 3. Raekwon Gray drove the ball in overtime, missed, and Jalen Wilson was right there for the offensive rebound and put back.
Yeah, it did see that.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exciting. I mean, I think, you know, plot him, you know, if you want to plot him on a continuum from like TLC to Kessler Edwards, like, you know, I think he's that type of player at a plug and play premium position. So I think the fact that he can kind of step in and be, it doesn't seem like he really takes things off the table in any particular area. Yeah. Obviously more of an offense first guy without necessarily a ton of defensive upside. But like, you know, to me, like that's like a guy that can step in and be your 11th man like really easily. And I think that's great value to get at the 44th pick in the draft. And a dude that's already on a two-way contract. So he doesn't even need a full roster spot to do that and be able to contribute that way.
Yeah, it's just the value of drafting older players in the second round. It doesn't mean he's any better or even any smarter than Noah Clowney, but he just has X amount more experience, and because of that, he has more feel, and he's a little bit more confident with what to do, when to put the ball on the floor, whereas Clowney is still feeling things out and seems like a hard worker. But speaking of Clowney, one thing that really impressed me about him is dude can really shoot free throws, and the free throw shot looks good, and that makes me very positive on the three-point shot moving forward, even though he didn't shoot great in summer league. But I will say that he got shots up. I think he shot 7 in one game, 6 in another, and it wasn't awkward looking. It was actually quicker than I thought, and the ones that he made looked super smooth. And he was shooting them. It's not like he was posting up in a corner and waiting for somebody to pass to him. Some of these were moving a little bit, 3-4 feet behind the arc. So his willingness and ability to get up shots looks smooth out there. I think that is going to translate again. Probably not this year, but I do now see the real path to him becoming a stretch big. And he also was not really afraid to challenge anybody that was trying to dunk on him or afraid to try to dunk on anybody else. And he definitely missed some, but he was getting up there and he was trying. And I love folks that are willing to challenge other players and aren't afraid to look bad by getting blocked or missed dunk and getting dunked on. So I love seeing that out of big men. And that's what I loved about Jared Allen early on too. He never seemed to shy away from folks that were going at him. And I think it really helped him. And Claxton was the same way. So I do see that upside there. And that's probably one of the things the Nets liked about him. He did try to put it on the floor a few times too, and it didn't go horribly. So that was a good time. Anyway, I came out of summer league more positive on Clowney than I thought I would be based on his ability to get those shots up in a smoothie or something.
No, that's good. And I saw somebody sharing his highlights, talking about like the Marcus Smart theorem of like, teams close out to your willingness to shoot more than they close out to your actual ability to hit. And obviously that carries some problems with it if, you know, they leave you open in a playoff game strategically or something like that. But for the most part, like in terms of being able to, like the idea of like him and Claxton potentially like existing in a front court together seems more open to me than I would have thought prior to what I've seen from him in summer league and his green light and willingness to shoot.
Yeah, that's what I was excited about. That's fairly exciting. He was getting up shots because somebody was passing it to him and he was just standing in the corner. Like he was moving around, trying to get open and looking for any sort of opening versus, oh man, I'm not right at the line. My feet aren't aligned in the exact right way. I need to get in my form here. He's like, no, I know how to shoot and I'm putting it up. So that was really fun to watch. The last thing that I'll say, and this guy's probably not going to be on the team, but I hope he's on an NBA roster next season, is Armani Brooks is just fun, man. That guy gets up threes. He makes a ton of them. Having him on the summer league roster to generate offense, stretch the floor, dribble a little bit, made the rest of the players better and made our offense a little bit more coherent and allowed the Nets to flow. So I'm glad he was on the roster. He's been fun to watch. Yeah. Nice. Any thoughts on that? If not, we can talk a little bit about FIBA.
Let's talk FIBA.
Okay. All right. So the only thing I want to talk about with this FIBA roster, which I think I'm probably one of the only people that's excited to watch FIBA, given the folks that are on there. But I like it because it's going to be such weird lineups and seeing how well we compete against the rest of the world, because they have very much caught up to us and we're bringing our C players, not our A players. But you hear all of this noise about FIBA, the Olympics, being the place where stars befriend other stars and then ultimately recruit or leave to play with those other stars. And consequently, the Nets just happen to have two players on the FIBA roster, Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson. And this might be a chance for them to form a few bonds, make a few friendships, sing the praises of living in New York City, the advertising opportunities, the additional revenue that you could get. So I thought it would make sense for us to talk through which players we view on the roster as A, recruitable, and then likely to leave. And then we can talk about which ones we actually want.
Okay. Ahead. All right. I'll start with two names just off the rip as guys that I would like, that I think some stuff needs to happen, but I think it's not out of the realm of possibility that they could be available. And that is Brandon Ingram and Jaren Jackson Jr.
Jaren Jackson. Wow. He's on your list. Damn. Okay.
I think he would fit so perfectly.
Oh, he would.
And that's, I mean, it would be amazing. I for that to happen. I mean, you'd need Ja to like really crash and burn. I think like that whole situation would need to go completely haywire. And I don't even know. I don't know. That one's maybe tougher to foresee. I think, I'm also certainly not rooting for that type of outcome. Just given the sort of off court stuff that would have to lead into it. I think Ingram is a much more realistic, target. That would be a pretty fun get, I think, in Brooklyn and can make a lot of sense.
Oh, he would be a ton of fun. So real quick, I'm just going to read through this roster too, and then I'll talk about my picks, but the roster right now is, Paolo Banchero, Mikal Bridges, Jalen Brunson, Anthony Edwards, Tyrese Halliburton, Josh Hart, Brandon Ingram, Jaren Jackson, Cam Johnson, Walker Kessler, Bobby Portis, and Austin Reeves. So it's really the Villanova special. If I had to rank the players that I think are, or if I had to list the players that I think are recruitable in the short term, what I wrote down was Bobby Portis, Josh Hart, Brandon Ingram and Anthony Edwards. And I think, you know, Anthony Edwards might be there's no way that's possible type guy. And if I had to rank them in terms of who I actually think is the most gettable, yeah, I think Bobby Portis is number one there. Josh Hart, number two. I mean, Ingram three and Anthony Edwards last. And the only reason I had Anthony Edwards on there is similar to the reason that you listed for Jaren Jackson, which is you could see the scenario in Minnesota blowing up if they decide not to flip one of Cat or Gobert and they run it back again and the Timberwolves are at best an eighth seed, where if you look at how some of those teams have improved in the West, they're probably going to be a play-in team again and they might not make the playoffs, and eventually someone's gonna
I think they'd keep it at all costs. I think Portis makes a ton of sense, just especially with this sort of iteration of the Bucks kind of aging a little bit, and he just, like, I think you could easily make the case that he slides in as a starting power forward in Brooklyn, or at least plays starter minutes as kind of like that, that 4-5 tweener that we talked about. And I don't, you know, I don't know that he's realistically gettable right now, but he's also somebody that I could easily see moving as a free agent. Even though we sort of talked about like free agency not really being a thing, but like for somebody at his level, I think it's a lot more realistic than like somebody at a Brandon Ingram level. You know, yes. Josh Hart, I think would be a great fit with this team as well. I mean, I know he just signed that big deal with the Knicks. I don't really see him moving, but it could happen. And I just feel like for somebody who's as good of a rebounder as a guard as he is, like I think he would make a ton of sense too.
So Josh Hart, it was a short contract, right? Or maybe I'm thinking about that incorrectly.
You might be right.
Let's see. It's June 12th. Okay. Anyway, we can look that up in a second. I know I had Ingram on there. My worry with Ingram is similar to what it was with Dame, which is it's going to take more than I'd be willing to pay for him to get him to Brooklyn. And I'm willing to do that if the person that you're bringing in is the 1A star that can lead a team to a championship. I don't think that Ingram is that guy. I do think he makes us infinitely more fun, but I think we would have to give up a ton to get him and really hurt the flexibility to pick up that second star that would be needed to contend for a championship with Brandon Ingram on the team. So that's, you know, even if we do recruit him, it's just tough for me to see him out in the best way possible for the Nets.
Yeah, I mean, I do think Ingram, like, I know he's not like a great defender necessarily, but I just feel like the amount of length that you'd be able to throw on the floor at a given time between him and Bridges, like I think there's some cool like surplus value things you could do, and I feel like he's been, I don't know, like the second half of last season that he had was pretty incredible, and I feel like he's got a little bit of rising star potential there, so I don't know, I'd be interested in that,
man. And we'd have somebody that could score in the clutch, right, for us. It would solve all of our problems. But man, just having somebody that can rise up and hit
and it would open it up to like obviously this isn't the linchpin of the whole thing, but like, you know, you could keep somebody like a Dennis Smith Jr. even as like a, you know, particularly if you got like Ingram and Bobby Portis. Like I think you could open it up in other ways. Or if Simmons was playing really well, like that could be kind of a fun lineup too. Like if you went Simmons, Ingram, Bridges, Johnson, Clax, maybe like that's some fucking blank. Like that's a lot of arms to be trying to pass the ball through.
Oh, that would be awesome. Our podcasts are becoming 6 degrees of Dennis Smith.
Absolutely.
Jr.
Yeah.
Listen, that actually leads back to him. DSJ, baby.
I'm driving the fucking bandwagon for that.
Any other FIBA thoughts, or do you want to wrap with a couple quick hitters on the NBA in-season tournament?
Oh, let's go to the in-season tournament, baby. Old man yells at cloud. Let's all do right.
What are the NBA Cup, I believe they're calling it. They might not
Commissioner's
be the right
Cup,
term,
I something believe. Is what
Commissioner's
it
Cup. Thank you.
It is the NBA Cup. Cup. Commissioner's Cup is the WNBA version.
NBA Cup. Got it.
So here's my thing, right? Like, why the fuck do people not like this? Like I get, like, if the negative is going to be like, well, who cares? That's fine. Like, who cares about the regular season at that point of the year anyway? And, you know, I don't know if it's just because I grew up watching so much college basketball, but like, is it a meaningful achievement that like UConn won the Phil Knight Invitational last year, or wins the Battle for Atlantis, or the Maui Invitational, or the preseason NIT, or the fucking Duke's mayonnaise, like, you know, tub of mayonnaise tournament? It's a real one. It's not, but it's fun. Like, it's still fun. Like, it's fun to have a game. It's kind of like the Christmas game or something like that. Like, it doesn't count in the standings anymore than, you know, winning something else. Like, I don't care how they monetize it or if guys like care, but like, you know, like I feel like when you're in a tournament setting, like, these guys are competitive enough that they're going to want to win. It's obviously not the ultimate goal. You're not going to play through an injury to, you know, hoist the NBA Cup in November or December or whenever it is, but like, it adds some pizzazz to, you know, otherwise what would be an uninteresting portion of the season. And it sets you up for potentially getting some cooler matchups, which I feel like is like, that's always the big draw in college. And I feel like with the Commissioner's Cup in the NBA, like, or in the WNBA, excuse me, like, you know, we're getting an extra Aces, you know, Liberty matchup because of it. And you know, that's pretty cool. So like, I just don't see why people are upset that it exists. Just seems like, why wouldn't you take a swing at it? And if it sucks, then it's
To me, it seems like poo-pooing the league for trying something different just to see if it works, which is, we should be all about the league doing that, because they might stumble into something awesome. And you never know how something's going to turn out until you... When I heard about this, my first thought was, the absolute worst case scenario to me is that only the young teams and the younger players take it seriously, which is still going to be super fun. And the way that I was thinking about it is like, performing on the big stage, completely. That's how players establish their legacy. The players have announced that we think that performing in the playoffs, winning championships is the most important thing. We don't want to take the regular season that seriously. We want load management, et cetera, et cetera. I get that. Totally. Awesome. But younger players tend to be on younger teams, tend to be on bad teams. They don't get those opportunities to perform on a big stage. So this is going to be, oh, wow, I'm going to have some win or go home scenarios to really show off. This is a time where I can shine versus I'm always sitting at home at the end of the season while these other players and these other teams are on the big stage. I'd love to go out there and make a name for myself. So I see that as worst case scenario, with some younger players really trying to take advantage of that and build their legacy through it. And the other thing I was thinking about, and again, I'm going to tie it back to college sports too, like you did, because I think it's the best comparison. But in college hockey in Boston, there's this thing called the Beanpot, which is a four-team tournament every year. That's Harvard, Northeastern, Boston University, and Boston. The games don't count towards the regular season. They win a literal Beanpot that's about 100 years old. But every year, these teams compete like it's the Stanley Cup Finals, Game 7, to win this guy pot. The stands are packed. The fans love it. It's purely for bragging rights. And the outcome is ultimately meaningless. But I love it every year. And it was the most fun thing to go to when I was at BC and I was in the Pep Band. And I don't think this will turn out like that, but that's what it could be. And it's worth a shot.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like, you know, it's basically doubling up on games that would otherwise already be scheduled. So they do count, like they count in the standings, and you know, it just like, it adds a nice little moment. Like it is fun when, you know, the 2006 UConn team won the Maui Invitational. Like, it's fun that they get to hoist a trophy for that. Like, I think it would have been cool last year if the Kings won or the Grizzlies won, or, you know, some of these up and coming teams or teams trying to prove themselves. It's just, it's an opportunity to establish that, in the same way that like Jokic playing Embiid, you know, with the MVP on the line was like a fun moment in the regular season, you know, in a way that's much more like, much more opaque, like the connection there is much harder to see. So I just, you know, I feel like it's a cool idea. Maybe it's redundant or, you know, whatever, but like, I feel like are up in arms about it. And I really don't see what the harm is in giving it a try. And if you want to be all stuffy about like the fucking sanctity of like the, you know, schedule and like playing against ghosts all the time, then go play fucking baseball. Like that is a sport that you can be all musty about, you know, that shit for. Don't do it for basketball. It's more fun. It's more forward looking. And like, why wouldn't you give it a try?
I didn't even thought about that. Imagine if we get Jokic versus Embiid in the final, like that, how happy, how much fun would that be? Because we're never going to see those two teams, those two guys play each other in the finals, most likely. But if we get that, cool. That's a nice little matchup where it means a little bit.
Yeah. And it's always a fun moment when, for whatever reason, like, everybody sort of gives a shit about the same game, you know, like whether that's like the Christmas Day slate, or that's like those first games after the NFL season ends when, you know, ABC has like the afternoon games. And like, there was that one a few years ago when it was like Curry and Westbrook, and like Curry's like drilling the, you know, crazy threes, and like, you like,
oh, it was awesome.
Like those types of moments, I feel like are what's fun. And I feel like the challenge for the NBA from a product perspective is like, with things like load management, and I don't necessarily have a problem with the players not playing every game. Like, I think that's fine. But like, there's this pretty clear message being sent, like the whole flip the switch phenomenon, the way that the Nets approached the last two seasons completely, like where, you know, yeah. players only care about the playoffs. The playoffs is like talked about like it's a completely different sport. And basically you're ending up playing like an 82 game regular season where like, if you don't really fuck it up, like you're going to get in and like, you can kind of go from there. Like it just renders the regular season so meaningless and, you know, so much playing out the string. Like, why wouldn't you, you know, put a little bit of novelty into things and, you know, just try to have a little fun, Brett. Just have a little fun.
The regular season, don't fuck it up. The playoffs.
Yeah.
Fuck it up.
Exactly.
It's a good mantra. I'm glad we're on the same page there. I just didn't really get the hatred towards it. Like, okay, maybe it doesn't work out. Then we just get rid of it. Who cares? What happens yeah. if it doesn't work out? Nothing yeah. has changed.
I mean, the one thing that I will also say is I do feel sometimes like the complaining about shit is like more a feature than a bug. Like to a certain extent, I think a lot of the things that people complain about, and they're like, well, why does the league do something about this? And it's like, well, no, it's you just like complaining about it. And if they did something about that, you would complain about something else, because that's just like what you're, that's that is the point. So
listen, you know, to me, Carl, we'll see. Dan Gundy died so we could get these flopping fines. Okay. He gave his career for these fines for the betterment of the game.
Dude, they got to get a Jeff and Stan booth together.
I would pronto. Love that. So much fun.
Pronto. Can I tell you a story about Stan Van Gundy?
Absolutely.
Do you remember the it's really about me and it contains nudity. Virginia Furman
oh, yeah.
win in the NCAA tournament this year was announced by Stan Van Gundy and Kevin Harlan. I was watching that game at the gym at work, and then I transitioned to taking a shower in the locker room. While that was kind of like playing out, like immediately stepped out of the shower, ass naked, checked my phone. I was like, oh my gosh, like they're about to have this crazy last possession. Threw a headphone in. And so I'm just like, so the memory that I will always have of that play is just standing dripping wet, ass naked in my office. Just like listening to Kevin Harlan lose his fucking shit and Stan Van Gundy be like, oh yeah, like, so, you know, that's the time that I was naked and wet and thinking of Stan Van Gundy.
That's
so.
The best excuse for being naked and wet in an office that I've ever heard.
So you can find us on Stitcher, SoundCloud, Breaker, netsfalse@gmail.com.
You can find us at wet naked in an office at gmail.com. it's been fun, Nets fans.
Stan Van Gundy looks like Ron Jeremy, right? Like that's like a thing, right? Like,
yeah, absolutely. He's always looked like Ron Jeremy. Now he looks like old Ron Jeremy.
Cool. And just to get this in while the music plays, how come all porn is about step parents now? With hard knocks, better than Berkeley. They said you murked me by the time I was 21. That shit disturbed me, but you never hurt me. Hello, Brooklyn. If we had a daughter, guess what I'ma call her? Brooklyn Carter. When I left you for Virginia, it didn't offend you, cause you know I only stepped out to get dinner. Hello, Brooklyn. How you doing? Hey, you don't think you might come soon? I can't, I'ma be your man. Be my lady and have my baby. Got my calls, got me crazy. Whatever you throw me, baby, girl, just take me. Cause I'm so taken, if you take it. I'm just saying, baby, I'm just saying. That's our back.